Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as the world's biggest anti-terror organization, warning of enemy plots to distort its image. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in Saudi Arabia as part of efforts by the two countries to boost bilateral relations. Also coming up, Israeli forces once again raid the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, killing one Palestinian and injuring and arresting several more. Welcome. Now, top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the enemy is seeking to tarnish the image of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the besieged volunteer force. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the reason behind the plot against the IRGC and besieged are their attractiveness that makes the enemy worried and agitated. The leader added the enemy tries to smear the IRGC by resorting to fake news and rumors, as well as different kinds of deception and ploys. Ayatollah Khamenei underlined that the enemy wouldn't like the IRGC to become a role model. The leader described the IRGC as the biggest anti-terrorist organization in the world. He praised the IRGC as a well-equipped, efficient and independent military body, which has not stopped its work since its establishment around four decades ago. The leader made the comments in a meeting with IRGC commanders. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in Saudi Arabia as part of efforts by the two countries to boost bilateral relations. Amir Abdollahian was received by top Saudi officials in Riyadh. He is visiting the kingdom on an invitation from his Saudi counterpart, Prince Faisal bin Farhan. The two top diplomats are set to discuss ways to develop all-round relations. Prince Faisal made a visit to the Islamic Republic in June, just weeks after Tehran and Riyadh agreed to resume diplomatic ties. The neighbors severed ties in 2016 following angry protests in Iran over the execution of the cleric Nimr Baqir Nimr in the kingdom. Now, both countries have reopened embassies and consulates, pledging to work together to bring security and stability to the region. The UN Security Council has strongly condemned the recent terror attack in the Iranian city of Shiraz that killed two people and injured several others. In its statement, the Council described the assault on the Shah Jaraq shrine as, quote, a heinous and cowardly terrorist attack on innocent people. The world body also condoled with the families of the victim and the Iranian government. It reaffirmed that terrorism in all its forms constitutes one of the most serious threats to international peace and security. The Council called for perpetrators, organizers, and sponsors of such attacks to be brought to justice. The Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility. Iranian security forces have already arrested the assailant and 20 suspects. Fuad Izadi is a professor at the University of Tehran. He explains who actually benefits from such terrorist attacks.
What ISIS has been doing is basically targeting Shia Muslims, not only in Syria, but in other places, in Afghanistan, in Iran, the past incident that we had. And who benefits from chaos within the Muslim countries? United States and Israel. And Trump, previous U.S. president, said this repeatedly, three or four times at least. I heard it personally, that Obama and Clinton created ISIS. And this goes back to Iraq and Syria when the Obama administration decided to achieve foreign policy goals using a terrorist organization. And they were basically paying money and giving weapons to anybody who was interested in overturning the Syrian government at that time. Mm-hmm. So overall, I think it would be too simplistic to think that two individuals would engage in these type of activities without any organization and backing. ISIS has claimed responsibility, and it's not very difficult to realize that the enemies of Islam, United States, Israel, are also benefiting and directly or indirectly engage in this type of terrorism.
There is no end in sight to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. A Palestinian man has succumbed to injuries he sustained during a pre-dawn Israeli raid on the city of Jenin. The victim has been identified as a 32-year-old Mustafa Kostouni. The attack came a day after the regime's troops raided the flashpoint city of Nablus, injuring dozens of Palestinians there. Israeli violence against Palestinians has been on the rise, with more and more Palestinians falling victim to Tel Aviv's brutalities day by day. At least 210 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories so far this year. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says fresh fighting erupted in the city of Jenin after undercover Israeli forces were exposed by Palestinians.
Israeli special undercover units raided the Jenin area, the occupied West Bank, in order to arrest Palestinians wanted for security reasons or even to assassinate wanted Palestinian fighters. However, these units were exposed by Palestinian fighters. Exchange of fire erupted. Immediately, the Israeli military sent more troops and Israeli soldiers to Jenin, to the Jenin city, and heavy clashes erupted, according to the Israeli military and according to Palestinians in the Jenin area. These clashes led to the killing of 32-year-old Mustafa al-Kostouni. It seems that Mustafa al-Kostouni was one of the Palestinian fighters, and he was shot in the head, in the chest, and the abdomen, and he succumbed to his injuries, of course. Another Palestinian was wounded during this Israeli military raid to Jenin. The Israeli forces arrested before leaving Jenin area two more Palestinians. One of them is a family member of the Kostouni.
Moving on to Turkey now, where a stark division has emerged among those who express unwavering trust in the government's economic strategies and those who remain skeptical, seeing no signs of a positive outcome. That as the Turkish president has vowed to ease the cost of living burden on the people as soon as possible.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating February earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's a naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Mehmet Şimşek was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we're not seeing any new investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implemented?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake and then elections. So what we are facing, from inflation to change in lira value, is normal to what country has going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis. But it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is why inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. Lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going now, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Elsewhere, Armenia and Azerbaijan have traded blame for the situation in the Nagorno-Karabakh region during an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
These humanitarian issues clearly need to be resolved with the international community's strong intervention before the negative consequences result in ethnic cleansing of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I shall start by categorically rejecting all the unfounded and grounded allegations on blockade or humanitarian crisis propagated by Armenia against my country.
The 15-member council met as an Azerbaijani blockade of the disputed territory drags into its ninth month. Recently, a former International Criminal Court prosecutor said the blockade may amount to, quote, a genocide of the local Armenian population. Meanwhile, a senior UN official told the council that the International Committee of the Red Cross must be allowed to resume the delivery of humanitarian relief to Nagorno-Karabakh.
The ICRC is doing everything it can, but as a single organization, it can only cover the most urgent needs. Impartial humanitarian relief must also be allowed to reach civilians who need it, and a sustainable solution for safe and regular transit of people and goods must be found.
Other Security Council members also addressed the session. Russia said it will use all diplomatic channels to prevent a humanitarian tragedy, as well as resuming the provision of essential goods to the region. The U.S. called on both sides to meet their obligations under international humanitarian law, while urging Azerbaijan to restore free movement through the corridor. Karabakh is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but is populated mostly by ethnic Armenians. Baku and Yerevan have fought two wars over the region. The latest conflict in 2022 left nearly 300 people dead and displaced more than 7,000. Now, there is a chaotic scene at Germany's Frankfurt airport as intense rainfall turns the runway into a swimming pool. Heavy rain and thunderstorms hit the German city, inundating roads and bringing traffic to a standstill. Video posted on social media showed that large parts of the runway were covered with water. The airport's website reported that some 70 flights were cancelled due to inclement weather. Thousands of passengers were also stranded. On Wednesday, the German Weather Service issued severe weather alerts across the state of Hesse. Ukraine says it will not be able to receive and use U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets in its war with Russia during the current year. An Air Force spokesperson, Yuri Ihnat, said Ukraine had big hopes to use the warplanes as part of the country's air defenses against Russian missiles and drones. Ukraine has repeatedly called on its Western allies to supply it with F-16 fighter jets. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsed training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of warplanes has been declared yet. Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. The death toll from devastating wildfires in the U.S. state of Hawaii rises further as the search operation continues. Hundreds more who remain unaccounted for.
We'll start with where we are in general. 110 individuals have been confirmed deceased. This is unprecedented. No one has ever seen this that is alive today. Not this size, this number, not this volume, and we're not done.
According to Green, rescue and search teams have covered 38% of the fire-ravaged town of Lahaina in Maui County. He said about 2,000 homes and businesses remain without electricity. Blazes forced harrowing escapes and displaced thousands. Officials have been criticized for failing to issue alerts and their lackluster response to the tragedy. Hawaii's Attorney General has already opened an investigation into the authorities' handling of the wildfires. According to the National Fire Protection Association, the Maui wildfires are the deadliest in the U.S. in more than a century, surpassing the 2018 Camp Fire that erupted in California.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين. الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the war on terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the war on terror today. But was this war on terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, you know, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections. And so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales, $46.5 billion. Gross profit, $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing. Total sales, $68.7 billion. Gross profit, $4 billion. 3. BAE. Total sales, $30.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics. Total sales, $32.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Gross profit, $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001 was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq, and famously Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said that around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact a list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. You know, it was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy, they would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state and in particular U.S. companies, you know, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going into Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. U.S. has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, you know, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, There were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashemi, and all the crew here on Hidden Files.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Brothers, sisters, dear listeners السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Welcome to the program مفاتيح الحياة Keys of Life One of the keys of life we have been discussing is parents The rights of the parents The right of the father The right of the mother How we should treat them Obviously from the words of the Ahlul Bayt We mentioned in a hadith from Imam Rida alayhi salam previously, where he says, "Anta wa malika li abik," you and whatever you own is for your father. Now, this is a concept that a lot of people discuss, a lot of people question. How could that be possible? I work, I do all this, then my father comes and takes it. Under what right? Under what circumstances? Obviously, there are matters of fiqh involved, which I don't want to get involved in. Okay, because it's a topic of its own. But there are matters of huquq, matters of rights. Al-Husayn ibn Abi al-Ala came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And he said to him, so he was asking him from a fiqh perspective. He says, مَا يَحُلُّ لِلْرَجُلِ مِنْ مَالِ وَلَدِهِ As a father, how much am I allowed to take from my son? How much can I take from him? So, for example, I'm a father, I have a son, he has money. Can I just go to him and grab money and come out? If yes, how much can I take? So the Imam says, قال عليه السلام, الصادق عليه السلام, قوته بغير سرف إذا اضطر إليه. He has the right to go to his son, take as much as required to sustain himself. Without obviously going in extravaganza. So, my son has money, let me take money and, you know, spend on myself. No, when your quut, your daily sustenance, you don't have it, you're allowed to go to your son. You can go to his bank account, withdraw money that you require to sustain yourself. That is your right when it comes to your children. So as a child, if my father comes to me and takes money from my account, or asks me for money, I give it to him. That's his right. Because me and whatever I own is the mulk of the father. Then Ibn Abi al-Ala, he asked the Imam alayhi salam, فَقَالَ لَهُ فَقَوْلِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ لِلرَّجُلِ الَّذِي أَتَاهُ فَقَدَّمَ أَبَاهُ فَقَالَ لَهُ أَنْتَ وَمَالُكَ لِأَبِيكَ What is that? What was that about? So the Imam alayhi salam, he gave him a specific answer. He said to him, only you take what you need. Ibn Abi al-Ala was trying to remind the Imam Sadiq that an event happened with the Prophet where a person, a son, brought his father to the Prophet and said, Ya Rasulullah, my father took my money. And the father says to him, dude, you and your money is to your father. But Ya Ibn Rasulullah, Ya Imam Sadiq, he's saying to me, he only allowed to take a small portion. Doesn't that collide with the Prophet? Because the Prophet says, everything is for the father. He can take everything. You're saying only a portion. Then the Imam explains to him this concept. However, before I go and explain what the Prophet was trying to mean, let us take a very short break and then inshallah we will continue this discussion. So make sure you stick around.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات The Keys of Life
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرون نماز و ثواب داره فرون روزون است
One volume the present volume مفاتیح الجنان is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying fasting etc
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in the Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life. So we said before the break that Ibn Abi al-Ala was trying to, you know, come to terms with what the Imam Sadiq said to him, that you're only allowed to take from your son that which sustains you, not more, you know, you want to go extra. And with the Prophet, when he says to the son that everything you own is for your father. So the Imam explains. He says, فَقَالَ إِنَّمَا جَاءَ بِأَبِيهِ إِلَى النَّبِيِّ. That son brought his father to the Prophet. فَقَالَ لَهُ يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ. O Messenger of Allah, هَذَا أَبِي. This is my father. وَقَدْ ظَلَمَنِي مِيرَاثِي مِنْ أُمِّي. He did not give me my inheritance from my mother. فَأَخْبَرَهُ الْأَبْ. Then the father told the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, innahu qad atlafahu alayhi wa ala nafsah. He said to him, Ya Rasulullah, his inheritance from his mother, I use it to spend on myself and on him. فَقَالَ أَنْتَ وَمَالُكَ لِأَبِيكَ. Then in this case, you and your money is for your father. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ عَنْدَ الرَّجُلِ شَيْئًا. And the man had no extra money to give to his son. All the money he had inherited from the mother was spent on them. أَفَكَانَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ يَحْبُسُ الْأَبَّ لِلْإِبْنِ. Do you expect the Prophet to hold the father a hostage to the son? How does that work? So when it comes to how much, obviously the Imam says, قُوتِ يَوْمِك. Obviously, don't exceed the قُوت, don't exceed the amount that you require to survive. But generally speaking, there is fiqh, jurisprudence, laws, ahkam, and there's akhlaq. And akhlaq sometimes precedes ahkam. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants me and you to deal with one another based on akhlaq rather than ahkam. Give you an example, between a husband and a wife, the law says a woman is not supposed to cook, clean, do all the stuff for her husband, right? But akhlaq says, no, you should, right? You should be nice to your husband, take care of him, do all this necessary stuff. This is what Lady Zahra Salamullah did and the good women do. They take care of the husband. Also, the husband does things that he's not required, but he does it. Why? Because there's mawadda and rahmah between one another. So akhlaq sometimes precedes the law. When it comes to the father, for example, I should not be waiting for my father to come and ask me for money. If it comes to shove that my father asks me for money, then I'm really a bad son. Really a bad son. Why? Because obviously I would know the state of my father. I know how much my father has. I know what he does. I know whether he works or not. I know his circumstances. Correct? If you know the circumstances of your father, yet alone you don't go yourself and give him money, you wait for him to ask, then there's definitely something wrong in this formula. If the father comes and asks the son or the daughter for money, then he's putting his face value under their feet. And this is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would not take lightly. So as sons, as daughters, we were meant to go to our parents and make sure that they are stable financially. Keep that in mind. So it's not a matter of, oh, my father, you're only allowed to take $100 out of my account. I can't give you more than that. That's just like fiqh. We should not go by fiqh. We should go by akhlaq. Keep that in mind. Inshallah, we will continue this discussion in other episodes. Until then, take care of yourselves. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.